Apprenticeship and Skill Learning, Intersection of Violin Mastery and Classical Education from a Christian Standpoint, was presented by Brandon Vance at Gutenberg College's Conference on Education, Mastery Not Factory, How We Learn What Matters, on February 22, 2014. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2014. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
A lot of you heard Brandon play Thursday night. It was wonderful. And Brandon is not only trained in classical education, but he is the two-time U.S. Scottish Fiddle Championship. He won his first fiddle championship at age 14. That's impressive. Brandon, I'm not going to tell you the title of Brandon's talk. He told me he altered it a little bit, so I'm going to let him introduce his talk and give the title. Please welcome Brandon Vance.
I have a varied background, and don't we all? I grew up playing the violin from the age of 6. My inspiration was, as I said earlier, if you attended the concert, was Johnny Cunningham. And now, while Johnny Cunningham wasn't best role model for life, he was a really darn good fiddler. And part of that set right there actually is a Johnny Cunningham set, which is one reason why I chose it. He was a showman, and had just that energy on stage that captured my imagination and made it basically started a trajectory of my life. And it just goes to show you don't have to be upstanding individual. You don't have to have it together to influence someone in a positive way. And that leads to the question of whether me looking at Johnny right now and saying, oh, I'm glad I'm not like that, is a bit pharisaical in and of itself. But the point matters is that God uses us in his sovereignty. And so that was just looking at my life trajectory is a great way of learning about God's sovereignty, even regardless of whether it's musical or not. My inspiration was Johnny Cunningham. I started the Suzuki method, which is a fine, wonderful, very methodical approach to learning the violin that works very well for young children, I think. And I did that for about 7 years. At the age of about 9, I'd say, I always had this in the back of my mind that I wanted to learn the violin, but I mean that I wanted to learn the fiddle specifically. However, my parents, in their wisdom, said, you need to learn how to play the violin before you're going to learn how to just fiddle. Because in their mind, and rightly so, I think, fiddling is a type of violin playing. You're going to learn your grammar. And wasn't that the Dewey quote from earlier? Who needs grammar, right? Who needs grammar? Who needs to learn how to play the violin? We do need to learn the skills necessary before we get to get the cake. And that was a very good thinking back on it, it was actually great incentivizing on my parents' part to say, oh yeah, once you get to like a few books into Suzuki, then you can start learning some fiddle tunes. And it was all very positive, but I had great, great motivation to learn how to play the violin. And in the process, I fell in love with classical music. So I had a dual benefit. What I want to talk about today is, of course, the theme of this whole workshop. Our workshop, is it really a workshop? It's a workshop. We're talking, we're interacting, so in a way it is a workshop. And the one thing I want to talk about is skill building as it relates, first of all, to violin playing, my violin playing. I suppose the mastery or the assimilation of the skills to play the violin. And secondly, my personal experience with classical education and how that intersects with my faith and violin playing as a whole. So, first of all, violin mastery and assimilation, there's a lot in common with the apprenticeship approach of the classical education. In addition to having a background in violin performing and the whole Suzuki method and having private lessons and doing all that, I also, from a very young age, had parents who believed, my dad especially, believed in the classical approach. And perhaps it was because of his experience in the public schools, I think probably much because of that, that I was encouraged to read books and just start digging. And I had the great honor, and I still to this day attribute much of my spiritual maturity to a man by the name of Wes Callahan in Potlatch, Idaho. He lives out in the country, and he's just this really accessible, nice guy. He's an amazing teacher. I studied with him all the way through my high school years. Studied great books with him. I studied Latin with him, and also Greek. I took math with other online tutors. I did the online correspondence course sort of situation, which at the time, and I guess it would be the mid-90s, was very, very cutting edge, very new. I know correspondence courses, universities are using them now, but that, at the time it was a very new thing, and you know, so we use those online chat programs and do the discussions. We do most of the quizzes. We do like some quiz, like for the language courses, it worked very well to do. You just type in, he types in, you know, a grammar question or a vocabulary questions, and then you just type in one answers. And what you can do is you can make a private chat, which is pretty cool because then everybody's responses are individual. So there's all these really great tools, and of course the technology, once in a while, technology would just be a problem, and we wouldn't have class that day. But it wasn't the end of the world, because we were all required to buy the books and have the real book there and mark it up or do whatever. I mean, some people don't like to mark their books, but at least take notes on the book and have it there so that we were learning, mainly self-learning throughout the week. This is a once-a-week tutorial service that was 1 hour long. We would study by ourselves during the week, come prepared with questions and comments based on the study questions that he would give us. And the class looked very much like what I've seen this week at Gutenberg. I've been here all week doing various lectures at the University of Oregon as well as here. And actually, that's something to talk about. Just my experience here is a great juxtaposition of two very different techniques of teaching and learning. Or as as was mentioned earlier, perhaps not learning and then learning. But my experience with classical education got me going because I was always the kind of person, maybe I don't think I'm unique in this way. I think everyone really has questions about it. We all have questions. Knowing when it's okay to articulate them is a big deal. Because when you're 12, 13 years old, you're impressionable. You have everybody is looking at you. You're trying to impress people. You're trying to think about what's okay, what's not okay to do. All these things, all these pressures are coming, and fears. And Tim spoke to that last night. All these fears inhibit us from asking the important questions. And what we need in teachers are people that are willing to take the time to say, it's okay. It's okay to ask those questions. In fact, not only is it okay, it's necessary to ask those questions. And that's what my classical education did for me. It's the same process that I did when I learned the violin. It's the same Socratic method that Andrew was using earlier on us all. So I don't want to ramble too much, but just to use my initial playing as an example. The piece that I played is in a certain style, and most of you have a basis for understanding that style. It's fiddle music. It has a beat. We know what the context is. It's for dancing, right? That, in the same way, is you were listening to this piece on its own terms to a certain degree, but you already were speaking the same language too. When we're reading a book, we're taking the book on its own terms. Even within the Bible, I think somebody said the other day something about the Bible being this fairy tale books, or saying that it's the Bible's. I take the Bible literally. Oh yes, somebody was ranting about Christians on Facebook, because that's what we do when we don't want to talk to people face to face as we rant on Facebook, right? It's amazing to me how much goes on Facebook that's just very, very caustic and doesn't actually get anything done. So this person was ranting about the fact that Christians just, you know, take the Bible literally, and just really blind sheep that take this book of fairy tales literally, and I thought to myself, well, you know what, I'm not going to grace this sort of the response, but at the same time, that's not true. It's not true. We don't take the Bible literally. There are at least three or four different types of literature in the Bible, in the Old Testament alone. And you have history, right? Now, history, we should be taking that pretty literally. Now, there is the epistles. That's instructional. It's how to live your life, and there are truth in that. There's truth in that. However, some of the Psalms, I probably should be interpreting some of the metaphors in the Psalms and some of the prophets. I'm not sure how literally to take that. You know, I'm not sure how literally I should take the book of Daniel, right? So the fact that there's some Christians are not equipped to answer that sort of criticism, blind criticism that's based on a lack of knowledge, and call it for what it is, but responding to it with grace. And that is what classical education, one thing that my classical education did for me was teach me to not, we already have the desire to think critically. My classical education did for me was teach me, give me the tools so that I was equipped to answer those questions, what the Bible calls us to do anyway, is to be equipped to give an answer when tested, when the situation calls for it. Now, the thing that I also want to talk about is Western literature. This is stuff you've all heard. Western literature is a grand conversation. And taking something on the author's terms, what is the author saying? Why are they saying it? These are all questions that we need to ask ourselves. And we can apply this to all parts of our life. We can apply it to our spiritual self-assessment, and so it is something we can apply to our spiritual life as well. And in fact, it is something that we should apply. There's different types of reading. That was a big thing that really was driven home to me. There are different types of ways to read different types of literature. So there's some topical reading, there's instructional reading, there's skimming something, which is mostly what we do in modern education. And there's reading for comprehension, which is not emphasized so much. In fact, that's the thing that probably I realize is most different about the way I read, is that I take the time. It's not, see, reading fast is not important. In fact, living life fast is not important. And we need to slow, in my opinion, we need to, no, I'm not going to say that, not in my opinion. We do, we need to slow down. And I believe that the method, approaching sources, as opposed to reading someone else's skimming someone else's summary, reading the Cliff Notes version, while it does require sacrifice and time and a little bit of struggle, it is that very struggle to master something like that, or to really learn the information comprehensively, as comprehensively as you can, that makes us better learners and makes us more successful. There's a book I was reading recently. I am actually still in the process of reading, I should withhold judgment before I give you my summary. But so far in the book, anyway, it's called David and Goliath, and it's famous right now. People have probably heard of it. Who's heard of the book? Yeah. Okay, at least a couple people have. He makes a point about education that I think is interesting. He takes kind of a middle ground. He doesn't say that class size is necessarily proportional to success, meaning that smaller class sizes are proportional to greater success in the students. He says that actually it's more of a bell curve, based on some research that's been done, that the actual success of the students rises a little bit when it gets to around the number 15, and then it sort of at 20 to 30, then they start to get lost, right? And it goes downhill again. The results, as far as these tests and things, which only have limited value, but it's still an interesting observation nonetheless, because we think smaller class sizes, better education. That's not necessarily true. The way it's what's more important than class size and all these sort of like little things that we, little mantras or pithy things that we come up with education, it's not that so much as it is what the content of what's being taught. That is way more important, and also the way in which it's being taught, and that is to develop these skills, that is to develop this mastery and the critical thinking skills, to exercise this muscle, which is our brain. I mean, it's a muscle. It needs to be exercised. And not just with little brain games and Lumosity. I'm not talking about that kind of thing. I'm talking about getting the tools, like logic, for instance. That's what I'm talking about. And no, it's getting the tools to learn how to learn. And that's just a simple, I mean, I'm sure you've heard that before, but it can't be emphasized enough. We have divorced ourselves from reason, and Andrew was saying earlier he made a great point that Darwin was this culmination of this sort of these two camps, the post-enlightenment divorce of reason and emotion, and just in general the sort of idea that we can know everything from the material, from material observation. When I play the violin, I know how to move my fingers. I know all the physical aspects and all the things that make up playing the violin. But I am not focusing on those necessarily when I play a piece for you. In fact, if I did, I would probably mess up. If I thought about how my finger was moving on the string and every individual sensory neuron in my finger and was all aware of that, I would probably set the violin down and never play for you again, like Van Cliburn. So Polanyi calls this focal awareness, as opposed to subsidiary awareness. And the focal awareness is that thing outside of the violin which I'm focusing on, right? It's a very simple idea, and yet it's kind of brilliant at the same time, because that is, we think, materialism at its end actually emphasizes the little finger movements to the point where ad absurdum. You can't get anything done with that. You can't go anywhere with that. It just reduces to a pile of ashes at the end. And the music is a great example of science even in and of itself. Polanyi also describes science as an art. And to me, I thought at first, well, is science really an art? But if you think about it, the people that practice science, they're doing experiments, but they're responding to the experiments. They're asking questions, right? Who is asking the questions? The thing being acted upon isn't asking a question. The scientist is asking the question, and that question comes from the scientist. And, well, you can say, yeah, it comes from our brain. But ultimately, at some point, we have to get back to first principles, and that is... And I'm not saying I'm a wholesale Polanyi guy. I just like what he said there. I agree with that. So that is just, to me, a really, really basic analogy. Now, a lot of what we do as artists, and I think this is a really good good thing to talk about for a little while, is the rhetoric. Music could be defined in certain contexts as a form of rhetoric. The reason that we learn rhetoric is so that the dialectic that we've already established, the thinking through everything and trying to find this truth, that can be expressed to other people, because that also, and rhetoric, the reason that rhetoric is valuable is because we as humans are designed to communicate with each other. We are designed to bless each other with our words. We don't always do that, but we are designed to do that. And music is a form of rhetoric. It is not, by definition, something, because it doesn't have words, it can't impart direct theology on anyone. You can't actually impart literal theology on someone, but you can impart beauty. You can share beauty with them, which is pointing to the truth of God's creation. Now, there's another definition of art that I'm interested in exploring, and I might be a little bit, this is not, it's a little half-baked, but I did notice that Andrew said something very interesting, and that is, and I don't want to misquote you, but that art, that God is intrinsically artistic. And I think I agree with that. He is intrinsically creative. But there's also another definition of art, and maybe that's just another one of these instances where we have to define our terms, is that there's another instance of art, which is artifice, right? Artifice, which means that art, to a certain degree, is illusion. In that regard, it could be good or bad. It's not a good or bad thing. When used by, maybe this is it, then when used by God, it is good because God is good. But when used by sinful humans, it is not always good. And that is something that, with regard to instrumental music, it's hard. It's a difficult thing because it doesn't have words. And I guess that's, if something has words, then you can talk more about whether the artifice of the lie is the honey on the rim of the cup, as it were. It's a quote from Lucretius. He was a philosopher, one of those philosophers who like Nietzsche, couched much of his philosophy in poems, and was very, very good at his own philosophy. He stated in the beginning of, I can't remember the name of it, On the Nature of Things, I believe. He said it himself. He said that the honey on the rim of the cup, what he uses is the poetry that he uses to make his message more easy to swallow, quite literally. And it's a good analogy. Music is, when performed well with great mastery, is honey. It's sweet. It's something that was pleasant to us. Now, music is also incorporates words, and so it can come from different worldviews, and that's where your what the content can of course be. The question is, is it poison or is it water? Is it something good for you? And that's where discernment comes in as readers and as thinking about things, and just assessing our culture at large and where it's going. And that's, yeah. So I think those are some of the analogies that I've come up with. But I think to tie this into my faith, I want to talk a little more about some basic stuff, which is stewardship. Stewardship is very, very important as Christians. Stewardship is the goal we're trying to reach is, of course, truth. We're trying to reach a like Christ likeness, and one of the ways we do that is in the stewardship of the gifts that have been given to us. Of course, there are gifts that everyone has been given, and according to the scriptures, I think it's in Ephesians, the spiritual gifts are listed. I believe teaching is among the spiritual gifts, which is an interesting one. So violin playing is not listed in the spiritual gift category, unfortunately. Shucks. But violin playing is a natural talent that can be cultivated and can teach people. So in that sense, it's a means of teaching. It's a means of encouragement. It's a specific means of communicating Christ's love to other people. So to think about things too narrowly and categorically is dangerous. Separating things too much is dangerous. And I think that, yeah, things are a lot more... This violin is just a piece of wood, right? We're just a bag of atoms. But there's got to be... I mean, that's what we see. And so if empiricism is true, then that's all you get. The problem with empiricism as a world philosophy is, well, first of all, it has a ton of holes in it. You can't say that as soon as you start having a thought, as soon as you start having any sort of moral feelings about anything that is right or should, or even just using the word should, it falls apart, because we're basing every one of those sentences on morals. It's all based on morality or some sort of something outside of ourselves that we are accountable to. I mean, should implies accountability. You have to be accountable to something before you should do anything. And nobody would argue that unless you're a really consistent anarchist, you wouldn't argue that there is the non-existence of that concept. So the mercy of music, I changed the topic of my lecture because I realized that the topic of my lecture was only a part of my lecture. So basically, the intersection of music and faith. For me, it's been one of my favorite quotes has always been, the aim and final reason for all music should be nothing else but the glory of God and the refreshing of spirit. And that's by J.S. Bach. It's also known as the Soli Deo Gloriam, which he wrote on some of his manuscripts. And that's beyond talent. That's what it's all about. It's about the fact that we, as I was saying earlier, that talent is good, but it is only good in as much as we are meeting our calling as Christians to glorify God and in our service to others. And pleasure's okay. Refreshment of spirit's good too. That's awesome, but it's only good in the right framework of glorifying God. There's a good book I read a while ago touching on this topic called Music and Theology by Don Saliers. It incorporates various forms of worship and how music plays an important role in connecting our bodies and emotions to our faith in a way that our heady culture views as unnecessary. And I think we sometimes do put too much emphasis on head knowledge, divorced from any kind of emotional interaction, and also divorced from reason. We divorce everything, and everything's just chopped up into little pieces. There's, like, I think you were saying, Andrew was saying earlier, that, and it's totally spot on. We're giving them a little chopped up dog. It's all the reason is divorced from the facts. We just learn the facts, but for no particular end outside of the learning of the facts. There's nothing to put it together. There is, and then on top of that, the head is divorced from the heart. There's no interaction. We wouldn't deny that. Our culture at large wouldn't deny that the heart exists. But let's not make them interact. That's the big thing. Let's not actually think about how my heart and my head interact. If I'm going to feel something, I'm going to feel it. I'm going to do what I want. Thank you very much. Don't make me think about it. If I'm going to think about something, I'm going to memorize some facts, and I'm going to get academic. You know, so there's this gulf that this divorce between the head and the heart, and it's a real problem. I think music has the ability to teach us how to marry those two things, because of its nature, because of its physical nature as a unifying activity. It's a multi-sensory activity. You're using your brain. You're using your body. You're using your brain for the whole thing, but you're using different parts of your brain. And you're also, and emotion. As a player, I'm getting emotional about it makes me feel a certain way when I play for you. If I get too emotional, then I can't play for you. But if my goal is ultimately to please you people, right? That when I play, I'm trying to make some order, some harmony take place. And but that requires a lot of focus and requires your entire being. I mean, when I'm playing the violin, I am incorporating my entire being into that. I think that life is the same way. It requires 100% of your being. It's not just church Sundays. We like to compartmentalize. I mean, that everybody does it. We don't do it because we have a good reason to. We do it because it's easier, and I think that's a way of. The discipline of music, or the discipline of anything for that matter, has important lessons to teach us. How to just slow down, think about it, and listen to God. So I'm not sure if that. I think that's all for today. I think I'm going to take questions now.
Okay, I guess this might tie in a little bit to what we talked about earlier as well as this, because there's an aspect of music that brings about manipulation, sort of, right?
Sure.
And with sometimes people abuse that as far as manipulating the people into a falseness. How can we learn to recognize that? As far as, because there is always truth, and recognize when we're being misled by music.
Yeah, that's a hard one. Well, first of all, there's a lot of circumstances where people are able to. I think Romans 15 is going to come to mind right away, because it's the one about causing your brother to stumble. I think all things are permissible, not all things are edifying, and I'm kind of paraphrasing that. But the idea that it's not a matter of unsafe. We're not on a safe to unsafe sort of modality. We're dealing with the actual presence of lots of different factors, and including personal experience and association. Some person might go to a rock concert and associate it with a really bad time in his life, you know, and someone else might go to that same concert and be able to appreciate the beauty or you know something else about that and be enriched by it. Now, if that person is advocating Satan worship or doing something like that, there's of course the obvious counterexamples to that. But unless someone's explicitly trying to make you feel something in a certain way, it's a tricky thing, because there's a lot of song with music. I mean, sorry, a lot of music with words, and a lot of those words are not edifying. And if you fill yourself with a lot of that, it's not going to be it's going to have an effect on your soul, in some regards. So I'm not trying to be legalistic, but at the same time, it is good to use prudence with regard to what we let in inside our body. I mean, you know, it's not trying to sound like Peter here and be a Judaizer, you know, like, you know, you can't eat ham. You have to be circumcised, and you can't listen to rock music, you know. So I don't. That's a real danger too. There's not a good answer to that, actually. So I mean, I can't find a good answer. Anybody else?
It's a part of one of the things as I'm growing as a Christian is realizing I'm cynical in nature, and I see emotional responses in the church because sometimes it's a false. There's falseness in some of the emotional responses in the church because it was brought about by the music itself without actually knowing what that was.
What the content is.
Yeah, and so I'm working on that as partly in myself is realizing that this is also partly me. But
a style thing, maybe? Am I putting words in your
really
mouth?
Style, but more of, there's like a formula to worship sometimes. That
a formula.
Plays
okay.
For a particular responses.
Yeah, and those responses don't always line up with content? Okay, yeah. I don't know. It's hard to be a judge of that. I mean, I want to remove the plank from my own eye before, you know, kind of thing. But yeah, and to a certain degree, when we're dealing with aesthetics, it's difficult to nail down any kind of empirical, you know, formula for that. It's not absolute. A lot of these things aren't absolute. So it's something where maybe for you do need more content. And that needs to be balanced with a message. I think if the church service doesn't include the preaching of the word, then that's a real problem. You know what I mean? That's where we can kind of put our finger on something. But you know, if the music is lacking in content, I don't know. It's a little bit subjective.
So we've kind of been talking all week. Brandon has been a guest in our house, and we've been rolling a lot of ideas around. And I just wanted to throw out. My analysis of Brandon when he plays is that I see a man who belongs to God. And so when he does that thing excellently that God has made him to do, that brings me a tremendous amount of joy. Because what I see is aesthetic excellence and superb intent married in a single event. What I think can be occurring sometimes in a Protestant worldview is that it's very easy to sort of confuse what is aesthetically excellent with what is morally excellent. And I think it's okay to distinguish and to say whatever musician who does not happen to share our worldview, who does not have a Christian worldview, I think that it's okay to appreciate and take pleasure in that which is aesthetically excellent, that which is well executed, well thought through. That doesn't, in other words, I don't think we have to throw out the baby with the bathwater because there are a lot of excellent musicians whose music brings me joy, and I simply don't know their disposition. And so, I guess it's more of a comment than a question. Yeah. But I would love to hear your thoughts, Brandon.
My thoughts on that. Yeah, it's to go back to aesthetically aesthetics. You know, they have a certain amount of. I mean, there is a certain amount of God's creation. God has put beautiful things in believers and non-believers' hearts. And it's given many people amazing talents. Whether they choose or not to acknowledge him is their, once again, their choice. That belongs to them. But I think that when the glory is given to God, that hopefully at some level is important. And you know, we are more than the sum of our abilities, and that's a really important thing to remember. Because that's the epistemology of music world is that you are the sum of your ability. Like you're only as good as your last show. That's a hard thing to live up to. It's impossible to live up to. That's why some people go crazy. That's you know some performance. That's why I don't know exactly what happened to Van Cliburn, but the story is he went out to play the Goldberg Variations and basically just played a few notes, had to restart. And then, like, just walked off stage and never played in public again. And that was the end. I'm not sure exactly what happened, but I wouldn't be surprised if it was something along the lines of, you know, he had his entire identity wrapped up in his performance. I can speak to that for my own experience, that I've bought into that lie a lot because it's the conservatory experience. It's what you do when you go to a high-level conservatory where everyone is performing around you and you're constantly comparing yourself to everyone else, and it's just, it's kind of crazy. It's a wonderful thing to master something, but at the same time, it's not everything. And we should, the integrity is really, really important. I'm not sure if I'm kind of going off on some tangent, but integrity is super. I mean, isn't that what music shows us? It gives us a picture of integrity. It is the whole thing. It is all these parts working together in harmony, just like the body of Christ. Just like all these things are the integrity is the whole. That's what we're desperately longing for. It's what our world is desperately longing for, and that's what we have to share. It's an exciting thing to be able to share this, you know, to fill in the pieces of that are missing in this pie. So it's a bad analogy, but yeah, I know personally when I am not living in integrity, my art suffers. I don't need to get into details, but you know, I've there's been parts of my life when I have lived in living in abject sin and rebellion, but in parts where I have not been living with integrity. I've been trying to do things my own way, on my own terms and not God's terms. And it hurt. I mean, it's not healthy. It's in your body. Your body reacts negatively to that sort of behavior, especially if you're a Christian and the Spirit's moving. It's in you. Things are going to not be okay inside. And that's a physiological thing. It's emotional, and it's based in the Spirit. When I was just last fall, there was the time when I was trying to do things my own way and not listening to God, not slowing down, just going fast, fast, fast. And I was having a really hard time just composing or doing my thing. I was doing my thing, but I wasn't able to do it, I don't think, at my potential because of a lack of, you know, integrity in my life, integrity before God, who I'm accountable to. And that sort of thing is super important to the artist and how they express themselves and what they it's super important. I mean, Christians can have integrity, non-Christians can have integrity. You know what I mean? But ultimately, we are responsible before God, and that's my measure is not the world's measure, and that makes a big difference in how in what comes out. You know what I'm. Yeah, anyhow, so.
I'm just curious about, you talked about music as rhetoric, so I'm kind of mm-hmm. curious what you or others would say, if music is a language, how that language has progressed in the history of Western music, for example, is, you know, you mentioned it can communicate beauty. I'm talking about nonverbal music, not song.
Okay.
You know, I do think there's a message in a lot of compositions. You know, there may be art for art's sake, but there's also clearly, you know, Tchaikovsky's Pathetique, for example, it's not necessarily beautiful to listen to. It's kind of painful because there's angst in it.
Uh-huh.
And yet there's truth within it. And we've been talking about pursuing truth. Do you think that Schoenberg or Charles Ives are conveying truth in atonality? Hmm. Is atonality a lie, or is atonality an expression of our age without the idea of morality, truth,
harmony,
invisible and realities? What would you comment about?
So my rhetoric and as an expression of what's the poison in the cup, as it were. I'm hesitant to call all of Schoenberg's work poison. I don't like it. I'll be completely honest with you. It's not my cup of tea. Can someone be edified by atonality? He wrote for Clairtonacht, which is not atonal. And then he wrote some bunch of expressionist stuff too. So it's very angsty. You're right. Even his intonal stuff is super angsty. I think music shows us a human emotion, and in as much as and it shows us struggle. You know, when we read Nietzsche, when we read some of these poets, they're in pain. They're in a lot of pain, and that's coming through. I'm not pretending to have been there like long, but I've been there for periods. I've been in some dark periods, and my art suffers for it. And when I do write art, it's painful. It's expressing pain. So they're still great masters of their tradition, right? But they're expressing this. Why are so many songs about breakups and you know, like just, you know, codependency and all these things? It's because that's what people are struggling with. They're struggling with their souls, and they're struggling with relationship and broken relationship. It's not just the broken relationships around them. It's a stem from the broken relationship with God. That's what it stems from. So I think it definitely expresses itself through atonality. I think their whole paradigm had to do with getting away from tonality, trying to obtain freedom. I disagree with the philosophy behind it completely. But I think that freedom is not found it's a dead end. It's a dead end road. I mean, you can only do so much but at the same time, if somebody was doing it for the right reasons, if someone was doing atonality for the right reasons, I would have a different. If somebody grew up with atonality as like their mode of musical language, I view that as a language and not good or bad. But their reason for doing it was not because that's what they grew up with, or that's what they were trying. Or they're trying to help people achieve harmony. Had nothing to do with it. Their reason for doing that was because they believed that harmony was, I think, on some level, institutional. It's like anti-institutional, anti-status quo. Like let's do this. Let's stretch this thing as much as we can, because rules are bars, and no rules equals freedom. Or creating a new tonal system will somehow help us get out of the constraints of what society is inflicted on us. So I'm not sure that's a very clear answer. I think that the music in and of itself is not good or bad. It sounds, right? If you are associating it with a certain world philosophy and it's leading you down a certain path, then that can be dangerous, right? If you're using music to further your... Here's the rub. If you're using it for that, it can be harmful. But if you're not, if you're just listening to something on its own terms, then it's the same thing it's the same process of the great books. You're reading a book on its own terms. You're listening to a piece on its own terms to see what the piece is saying. You can later read about, you know, Schoenberg and see what he was trying to do with it. I find Pierre Lunaire to be extremely disturbing, and it's just the first time I hear it. It's just like, this is putting me in a very dark place. I don't know if you're familiar with it, but it's got the Sprechstimme thing, and it's all sorts of, it's just very, Sprechstimme is when they go, oh, Blutena, and there's this kind of like song, like talky, like singing, creepy, like spooky Halloween thing that they do. It's very effective. So, you know, but whether or not, from an aesthetic perspective, it's effective at making me kind of creep out. But but whether it's artistically sound, I think I would not listen to him to be edified or spiritually edified. I would listen to him to be to think about it, you know, to think about what's going on and why he's doing that, maybe on a philosophical level. That's my answer. It's kind of long.
Okay, I have a question about, you mentioned the different types of reading, mm-hmm. topical, skimming, comprehension. I don't know if you listed more that I may have missed.
As far as reading, yeah, it's types of reading. I think that those are the building blocks. No, that was it.
Okay.
I mean, there's. I think there might be another one, but those are the ones that I use most frequently. Syntopical is the first one, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Syntopical. Reading.
Syntopical.
Syntopical reading, yes.
Okay, so now I need to ask what you mean by that.
Oh, yeah, no, syntopical. Yeah, thanks for asking. So syntopical reading is when you're reading just a lot of across the board, like, and syntax. So you're reading across, like you're taking one idea and seeing what a lot of different authors have to say about it.
Okay.
So theme. It's
so that changes my question. It actually deletes out my question.
Okay, well, yeah, so instead of just reading an author, you read several authors that cover the same topic. I mean, that's my understanding of it.
Okay, thank you.